This is the reading of the Agriculture course by Rudolf Steiner. This is Lecture 7, given in Kobervitz, Sunday, June 15th, 1924. In the time we have remaining, I would like to supplement what we have already considered with something about raising animals and growing fruits and vegetables. These, too, are branches of agriculture that are impossible to consider properly, unless we do everything possible to gain insight into the true state of affairs. We will do that today and then continue with practical suggestions and applications tomorrow. I need to ask you to bear with me in pursuing some things that may seem somewhat remote, because today these things are like a completely unknown territory, even though they were quite familiar in times when farmers had a more instinctive insight. Nowadays, we tend to look at the beings of nature, the minerals, plants, and animals, we'll leave out human beings for the moment, as if they stood there in isolation. We're in the habit of looking at a plant all by itself. Then we go on to look at a plant species by itself, and then at another species next to it. Everything we are supposed to know about these things is neatly pigeonholed into separate species and genera. But that is not how things are in nature. In nature, and actually throughout the universe, everything is in mutual interaction with everything else. In this materialistic age of ours, we follow up only the coarser kinds of interplay, when one thing gets eaten and digested by another, for instance, or when the manure from animals is spread out on the fields. These coarser interactions are the only ones we investigate. However, there are also more subtle interactions that are brought about by finer forces and finer substances, by the warmth, by the chemical ether that is constantly at work in the atmosphere, by the life ether. And there are some other areas of agricultural endeavor where we will make no progress at all unless we take these subtler interactions into account. In particular, these more intimate interactions in nature must be considered when we are dealing with the association of plants and animals on a farm. We need to look not only at the animals that are obviously very close to us, such as cattle, horses, sheep, and so on. We also need some understanding, for example, of the colorful and varied insects that hover around the plants at certain times of year and of the bird life on the farm. People have no idea of the extent to which farming and forestry have been affected by the fact that certain species of birds have been driven out of certain areas by modern conditions. We need to shed light on things like this once again, but from a spiritual scientific perspective, in other words, from a macrocosmic perspective. So now we can use some of what we have learned during the past few days to come to further insights. In looking at a fruit tree, whether it's a pear or an apple or a plum tree, you can tell already from its outer appearance that it is something totally different from any type of herbaceous plant. We must determine the exact nature of the difference. Otherwise, we will never understand the role played by fruit within the household of nature. I am speaking now about the kind of fruit that grows on trees. Let us look at a tree with an eye to what it is within the totality of nature. If we look at it with understanding, the only parts that we can consider plant-like are the thin green stems, which bear leaves, flowers, and fruits. These shoots grow out of the tree in the same way as herbaceous plants grow out of the soil. As far as what is growing on its branches is concerned, the tree is the soil. It is mounded up soil, soil that is simply in a more living condition than the soil in which our herbaceous plants and grains are growing. To understand a tree, we must consider, on the one hand, its thick trunk and its limbs and branches. On the other hand, there are the actual plants, the leaves and flowers that grow out of it. These plants are rooted in the twigs and branches of the tree, just as other plants are rooted in the earth. The question is, are these plants, these more or less parasitic growths on the tree, really rooted? Since there are no actual roots to be found in the tree, we must say that these plants that unfold their leaves, stalks, and flowers up there have lost their roots. that plants are not complete without roots. They must have roots. So where are they? In fact, the roots are there. They are just not visible to coarse outer perception. In this case, you must not want merely to see the root. You must comprehend it. Perhaps this comparison will help. Suppose I plant a lot of herbaceous plants very close together in the ground, and suppose that their roots start to grow together, twining around each other until they merge into a single mass of roots. You can imagine that this tangled mass would not be content to remain unorganized. It would consolidate into a unity, and the sap of the different plants would start to flow together down below. In this newly unified root mass, you would not be able to distinguish where the roots of the individual plants stopped or started. They would have developed a common root system. This may not happen in reality, of course, but it does help us understand what is going on. Here is the soil. There's a drawing. I set all my plants into it, and now down here the roots all grow together and form a unified layer. You cannot tell where one root stops and another starts. What I have sketched for you here, hypothetically, is what is actually present in the tree. The plants that grow on the tree have lost their roots. You could even say they have more or less separated themselves from their roots and only remain connected with them etherically. What I have sketched here, hypothetically, is the tree's cambium layer. The only way to look at the roots of these plants is to imagine that they have been replaced by the cambium. Although the cambium does not look like roots, it is the layer that constantly produces new cells for continued growth, just as if the herbaceous plant life above would be growing from a root down below. The cambium layer is the actual growth region. It can create new cells, whereas the other layers of the tree aren't able to do that. Thus in the tree we can see how the solid earthy element has in fact raised itself up, how it has grown up into the air, and why it therefore requires more internalized vitality than ordinary soil, which only has ordinary roots in it. Now we begin to understand the tree. We begin to understand it as a remarkable entity that exists in order to create a separation in the plants that grow on it. It separates their stems and flowers and fruits from their roots, and retains only a spiritual connection, an etheric connection. This is the macrocosmic approach we need to take in order to understand the growth of plants. But we need to go still further and ask what happens when a tree comes into existence. With respect to the air and outer warmth, what grows up there on the tree is something totally different from the herbaceous plants that grow out of the soil. A whole different world of plants exists up there. They have a much more intimate relationship to the surrounding astrality, which is given off in the air and warmth, so that the air and warmth can become mineralized in accordance with the needs of animals and human beings. The plants growing on the ground are surrounded by a hovering cloud of astrality, as I have described. But here in the treetops, the astrality is much more dense. Our trees are concentrations of astral substance. They are pronounced gatherers of astral substance. This is actually the easiest area, I would like to say, in which to achieve a degree of higher development. If you make an effort, you can easily develop esoteric perception here. You won't exactly become clairvoyant, but you could very easily become clairsentient with regard to smell. Cultivate a sensitivity to the different fragrances that come from plants growing on the ground, and those that come from orchards in bloom, or even from woodlands. Then you will be able to tell whether the atmosphere around a plant is poor in astrality, as can be smelled around the herbaceous plants growing on the ground, or rich in astrality, as can be experienced in the lovely scents wafting down from the treetops. If you make a habit of cultivating your sense of smell, and can distinguish between the smell of plants growing near the ground and the smell of trees, you will have acquired clairsentience for astrality that is thinner in the first case and denser in the second. It is easy for farmers to become clairsentient with regard to smell, although in recent times they have not put this ability to use as they did in the days of instinctive clairvoyance. As I say, a farmer can certainly become clairsentient with regard to smell. In order to see where this leads, we need to ask ourselves, what stands in polar opposition to the astrality around the tree, which these parasitic plants bring about? Parasitic is in quotes. What does the cambium actually do? You see, the tree makes the spiritual atmosphere around itself richer in astrality. What happens then when something resembling a herbaceous plant grows up there in the tree? The tree has, in a certain... The tree has a certain inner vitality or ethericity, a certain intensity of life, but the cambium acts to damp down this vitality to a more mineral level. In other words, while a rich astrality comes about outside the tree, the effect of the cambium is to bring about a poverty of ether on the inside. In comparison to herbaceous plants, trees are inwardly poorer in ether. A poverty of ether arises here, and there's another drawing. This poverty, in turn, influences the tree's roots, which become much more mineralized than the roots of herbaceous plants. And because their roots are more mineralized, these withdraw some of the ethericity from the soil around them. The soil around trees is therefore more dead than it is around herbaceous plants. It is important to keep this clearly in mind. A phenomenon like this always has a deeper significance within the household of nature. If we look around, we can discover the significance of the astral richness around a tree's crown and the ether poverty around its roots. The rich astrality wafting through the trees provides the life milieu for the fully developed insects, and the ether poverty down below, which naturally extends throughout the trees, since I described yesterday in relation to human karma, spiritual things always extend their influence over the totality, this ether poverty works on the insect larva. If there were no trees on earth, there would also not be any insects. Trees make it possible for the insects to exist. The insects fluttering around the above ground parts of the trees and all through the forest depend on the forest for their life, and their larvae too are alive, because the forest is there. This is a further indication of the intimate relationship that exists between everything root-like and the underground animal world. Trees are the best example of what I've just described. Trees are the best example of what I've just explained. That's where it is most evident. But what is so clear and striking in the case of trees is actually present in varying degrees in all plants. Within every plant there is a certain tendency to become tree-like. In every plant the root and its surroundings try to release the ether, while everything that grows upward tries to attract and condense the astrality. The desire to become tree-like is actually present in every plant. Thus every plant has the same relationship to the insect world that I described as being particularly characteristic of trees. But, in addition, this relationship to insects widens out to include the animal kingdom as a whole. In times past, the insect larva, which can only survive on earth because of the presence of tree roots, evolved into other types of animals which resemble them. These animals spend their entire life in a kind of larval state, but they free themselves from the dependency on tree roots in order also to establish a connection to the roots of the herbaceous plants. As we shall now see, the remarkable thing about this is that certain subterranean animals, albeit only very distantly related to the larva, are able to regulate the etheric vitality in the soil when it increases too much. When the soil becomes too alive and exuberant, these underground animals make sure that the excess vitality is released. Their special importance for the soil lies in their ability to serve as regulators or safety valves for the underground vitality. These wonderful little animals are the earthworms. It would be important to study the relationship of the earthworms to the soil, because it is the earthworms which make sure that just enough ethericity is left in the soil to support plant growth. So, down in the ground we find earthworms and other creatures vaguely reminiscent of larvae. And indeed, in certain soils, which can be recognized just by looking, it would be good to encourage the earthworms. Then you would see how beneficial it can be to control this underground animal world, not only for the vegetation, but also, as we shall see, for the animals. Now, again, there is a certain resemblance between the mature insects that fly and certain other animals, namely the birds. In the course of the earth's evolution, something wonderful took place between the insects and the birds. To put it pictorially, one day the insects said, "We do not feel strong enough to manage the astrality hovering around the trees, so we are going to leave most of it for you birds. Instead, we will flutter around the other plants and make use of their desire to become tree-like." That is how a real division of labor between the birds and the butterflies came about in nature. These winged creatures work together in a quite wonderful way, sharing the work of distributing the astrality wherever it is needed in the air above the earth's surface. If you took away all the flying creatures, this astrality would fail to fulfill its proper role, and you would notice a certain stunting of the vegetation. Winged animals and everything that grows upward into the air belong together. It is impossible to imagine one without the other. That's why on a farm we also need to have the insects and birds fluttering around properly. Farmers must understand something about fostering insect life and bird life, because everything in nature is interdependent. Everything. I have to emphasize this again and again. We need to keep these things vividly in mind, because they are very important for our insight here. The right astralization of the air is brought about by the world of flying creatures, and this astrality is in interaction with the wooded areas, which direct it in the right way, just as, in our body, certain forces direct our blood in the right way. The effect of a forest is felt over a very large area, and in areas with no woods, this function must be performed by something else. We must realize that in areas where fields and meadows alternate with woods, the vegetation is subject to quite different laws than in vast treeless regions. You can tell that some regions of the earth were heavily forested before human beings had anything to do with this, for in certain matters nature is still wiser than people are, and it's safe to assume that if forests are naturally present in a given area, that their presence has certain advantages for the herbaceous and grassy vegetation of the surrounding farms. In such areas, we should be insightful enough not to cut down all the forests, but rather to take good care of them. However, since the earth is also slowly changing due to all kinds of climatic and cosmic influences, we should also have the courage, if we see the vegetation on our farms is becoming stunted, to expand the wooded areas in the vicinity, instead of merely doing all kinds of experiments on and with the fields. On the other hand, if we notice that the plants are growing rampant and lack the strength to form seeds, we should take steps to clear certain areas in the woods. In areas naturally destined to be wooded, regulating the woodland is simply part of farming and must be regarded in its full spiritual significance. Now we can continue and say that while the world of insects and birds, everything that flutters and flies, is in interaction with the astrality, the world of the worms and larvae is in interaction with the lime in the soil, with the mineral aspect of the soil. The subterranean world of worms and larvae is in interaction with the soil's mineral aspect, in particular with lime, and in this way, the etheric is led off, as I described a few days ago from a different point of view. This is lime's function, but it exercises it in cooperation with the world of the larva and insects. You see, if we take what I have presented here a bit further, we come upon other things which, in the days of instinctive clairvoyance, were applied quite correctly, simply out of an instinctive feeling. I would not trust myself to apply them with that same certainty, We have lost our instinctive grasp of these things because our intellect has exterminated our instincts. That people have become so intellectual and clever is due to materialism. In the days when people were not so intellectual, people were less clever, but much wiser. They knew how, out of their feelings, how to do things that we must now learn to do consciously, by means of anthroposophy, which is not clever, but rather strives toward wisdom. We need to approach an all-encompassing wisdom once again, and not be content merely to rattle off the words, quote, the human being consists of physical body, etheric body, unquote, and so forth, which can be memorized like a recipe. That is not the point at all. What is important is that the knowledge of these things be introduced everywhere, that we recognize these things in everything we meet. If we become clairsentient in the manner I explained, we will be guided to recognize the way things in nature really are. As our perception becomes sharpened, we will discover, for instance, that the bird world can become harmful if there are no coniferous forests nearby to make good use of what the birds accomplish. And once this peculiar relationship between the birds and the conifers is recognized, then another relationship becomes apparent. To begin with, it is a very delicate and subtle relationship, like those I have mentioned, but it can also become more coarse. It is the relationship between the mammals and all those plants that stop short of becoming trees, yet also do not remain as small plants. The bushes and shrubs, in other words, hazelnut shrubs, for instance. For the benefit of the mammals, on a farm, it is a good idea to plant bushes and shrubs throughout the landscape. These shrub-like plants exert a favorable influence simply by their presence, for everything in nature is in mutual interaction. But let us pursue this further. Since animals are not as silly as people, they notice this relationship very quickly, and once they have become aware of their inborn love for shrubs, they like to receive them as fodder, and they eat them in just the right amounts to have a wonderfully regulatory effect on everything else they eat. If we trace these intimate relationships in nature in this way, we can also acquire insight into the nature of pests. Just as the coniferous forests have an intimate relationship to the birds, and the bushes have an intimate relationship to the mammals, so do all the fungi have an intimate relationship to the lower forms of animal life, to the bacteria and similar creatures, particularly the harmful parasites. The harmful parasites go hand in hand with the fungi and appear wherever fungi are present. In this way, plant diseases arise and also coarser abnormalities. But if, in addition to woodland, we also manage to have some wet meadows near the farm, these meadows will prove very helpful to the farm by providing a good soil for the mushrooms. We should actively encourage the mushrooms and toadstools to grow in these meadows. You will then experience the remarkable fact that if you have even a small area where mushrooms are growing, their relationship to the bacteria and other parasitic creatures will keep these creatures away from everything else. The mushrooms have a much stronger relationship to these creatures than the other plants do. In addition to what I already described for combating such plant pests, it is also quite possible to keep harmful microorganisms away from the farm simply by establishing some wet meadows. The correct balance of woods, orchards, bushes, and meadows with their natural growth of fungi is so essential to good farming that your farm will really be more successful even if this means a slight reduction in your tillable acreage. There is no true economy in using so much of your land that all the things I've mentioned disappear. The resulting loss in quality will far outweigh the advantage of being able to cultivate a larger area at the expense of the other things. Without this kind of insight into the interconnections and interactions of nature, it is really almost impossible to engage in an enterprise like farming, which is so closely bound up with nature. Now, there is still time to consider certain points that will bring home to us the fundamental relationship between plants and animals. What is an animal actually? And what actually is the plant world? With plants, we can speak in more general terms. We need to discover the essential relationship here, if for no other reason than to understand how to feed our animals. We can only feed them properly if we do so with an understanding of the proper relationship between plant and animal. So, what are animals? You can certainly study animals by dissecting them and viewing the delightful forms of their skeletons, which you can even study in the way I pointed out earlier. You can certainly also study their muscles and their nerves. But all this will not help you understand the real significance of animals within the household of nature. This can only be understood by looking at the aspect of an animal's environment with which it interrelates most directly and intimately. In its nerve sense system and part of its respiratory system, an animal assimilates directly from its environment everything that comes via air and warmth. As a being in and of itself, an animal is essentially a direct assimilator of air and warmth through its nerve sense system. We can represent an animal schematically like this, another drawing. In addition to everything that surrounds it, in its nerve sense system and part of its respiratory system, an animal is an entity that lives an unmediated existence in air and warmth. It has a direct relationship to air and warmth, and its skeletal system is actually formed out of warmth, because the warmth mediates the influences of the moon and the sun. Its musculature is formed out of the air, by the forces of the sun and the moon working via the air. On the other hand, an animal cannot relate to and assimilate earth and water in the same direct way. It has to take earth and water inside its body. It has to have a digestive tract going from outside in. An animal assimilates earth and water by means of what it has become through air and warmth. That is, by means of its metabolic system and part of its respiratory system. The respiratory system passes over into the metabolic system, and the animal assimilates earth and water with part of its metabolic system and part of its respiratory system. In other words, an animal has to exist already, thanks to air and warmth, in order to assimilate earth and water. That's how an animal lives in the realms of earth and water. Of course, the assimilation I have just mentioned is more an assimilation of forces than of actual substances. In contrast, let us now consider what a plant is. A plant, in fact, has the same kind of direct connection to earth and water that an animal has to air and warmth. Through a kind of breathing and through something remotely akin to a sensory system, a plant assimilates earth and water directly, just as an animal assimilates air and warmth directly. Thus, a plant lives an unmediated existence in earth and water, just as an animal lives in air and warmth. Now, after seeing how a plant lives directly with earth and water, just as an animal lives with air and warmth, you will go on to say that a plant must assimilate air and warmth within itself, just like an animal does earth and water. But that is not the case. You cannot simply draw conclusions by analogy if you want to get at the spiritual truth here. In actual fact, while animals take in earth and water and assimilate them inside themselves, plants give off air and warmth inasmuch as they experience them together with the soil. Air and warmth do not go into the plant, at least not to any great depth. Instead of being consumed by the plant, they are given off. And this giving off process is the important thing. As organisms, plants are the exact opposite of animals in all respects. Giving off air and warmth holds the same significance for a plant as taking in nourishment does for an animal. A plant lives by giving off air and warmth in exactly the same sense that an animal lives by taking in nourishment. This is what might be called the virginal nature of plants, that they don't want to greedily claim anything for themselves, but instead actually give to the world what the animals take from it. Plants give, and live by giving. If you observe this give and take, you will understand something that played a great role in the old instinctive knowledge of these things. Quote, in the household of nature, plants give and animals take, unquote. This statement is now made on the basis of anthroposophy, but in former times it was well known through instinctive clairvoyant insight into nature. A lot of these things remained available to sensitive people right down into recent times. Goethe, for instance, often uses the saying, everything in nature lives by giving and taking. You'll soon come across it if you go through his writings. He was simply borrowing it from old customs and traditions and did not quite correctly understand it anymore, but felt that it described something true about nature. People who came after him no longer understood anything about it, not even what Goethe himself had meant. He also spoke about giving and taking in connection with breathing, insofar as it interacts with the metabolism. His use of this expression was clear and at the same time unclear. We have seen now how forests, orchards, and bushes serve as above-ground regulators, so that the plant growth is properly ordered. Below the earth's surface, larvae, worms, and other lower forms of animal life join forces with lime to act as a similar regulator. This is the way we should approach the interrelationship of our field crops, orchards, and cattle, and we should take our cue from this when it comes to actual practice. In our final session together, we will try to get far enough so that our friends in the experimental circle can work out things from there. The end of Lecture 7.